Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 271 featuring Alex Sokolov, who is our GPU team lead at Chaos Group. And he's a really cool guy. I've actually known him for a long time. He's been part of the GPU team for a very long time as well, and knows a lot about ray tracing. Mm-hmm. Right, Kristen?
Yep. A lot.
A lot. And Kristen, let me ask you this. You don't necessarily know so much about ray tracing, but you learned a lot from this one, right?
I did.
A little techie? A little techie, this one?
Just a teeny tiny bit.
Yeah. But what did you find out? What do you think was cool?
Well, I mean, he was actually really inspiring to listen to because it seemed like he talked about in the beginning, like he was just good at math in high school and he's like, he didn't know what he wanted to do. So he thought programming was the way to go. He actually, I forget exactly where it happened, but
he didn't like it.
Well, he didn't like it. And then he listened to a talk by Vasco, one of our coworkers, and like that inspired him. And then he just started, and he's been with us 12 years now. I mean, I've only been here a year and a half, but
right. But he's he's been at the company for 6 years, because he's the same as me, basically.
Oh,
wait.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, 12 years is how long V-Ray GPU has been around.
Oh, that's okay.
Right, but he was inspired by ray tracing. Ray tracing itself was what turned it around, and that really said, oh, I guess I am interested in programming. I'm just interested in the ray tracing part of it. Mm-hmm. Which is pretty cool. And we learned a lot about ray tracing. Out of core. That's right.
Explain.
This is a kind of a big deal because since we can't obviously we're all working from home, and there was a conference he was supposed to go to in San Jose, which was canceled in terms of the actual event, but it was all done virtually, and he gave a presentation, which is the GTC talk in San Jose, which is the GPU technology conference. And he presented what we have done over the last year, which is traditionally what we do at all the GTCs. We go there and we talk about how much V-Ray has changed, V-Ray GPU has changed over the last year. And one of the big things we've been doing, obviously RTX is a big one, but we have been doing a lot of work in terms of what's known as out of core. Mm-hmm. And out of core is a big part of the GPU equation. And it's basically what happens when the scene data that you have can't fit in the memory anymore. And how do you handle that? It's not necessarily an easy problem to solve. And it's not just say, oh, well, just, you know, swap RAM and stuff, because sometimes that can really slow things down to the point where it becomes pointless to actually even use GPUs at that point. So it's a really good conversation. And we talked about all the different levels, right?
Yep, you did.
Yeah, it was kind of amazing. Out of core is a big part of this. Mm-hmm. All right, so don't want to get too much in the weeds and spoil the whole podcast. So let's talk about some cool announcements. What's going on in the world of of our announcements going on? There's some cool stuff we're doing, right?
Yeah. So we actually just launched our education collection. So that is out. And if you go to chaosgroup.com/V-Ray/education-collection, you can find this. It's $150 a year. And it's all the V-Ray products except for Katana and Nuke. And then Phoenix for Maya and Max are also included in the collection. So
yeah, it's a big deal. If you're in school or you're an educator and you want to have V-Ray, $150 a year gets you all of V-Ray. Meaning if you have V-Ray for Max, V-Ray for Maya, V-Ray for Houdini, V-Ray for SketchUp, V-Ray for Rhino, V-Ray for all of that stuff, V-Ray Unreal, Phoenix, all of it. So you can get $150 a year will get you every version of V-Ray, which is a pretty big deal. Like with two exceptions, actually, you said V-Ray for Nuke and V-Ray for Katana are not included in the bundles. I think there's a reason behind that, but it's a really good deal. And we're putting it out there for anyone who's in the education world. You want to learn it, go ahead and grab your copy. $150 is a pretty good deal.
Yeah.
Yep. And well, there's another one we have too, right?
Yes. So we do have a cloud discount. Everyone's working from home, so you can render at home, no bundles. And this will run until the end of April. So the credits do expire after you purchase, and they are good for 3 months after purchase.
Right. Mm-hmm. So we used to do bundles. So the more credit bundles you bought, the more of a discount you would get, which is kind of a traditional way of doing things. And in order to help people out, we decided to forgo all the bundles and just give everyone the maximum discount, no matter how many, you know, credits they buy. They buy one credit, they buy, you know, 1,000 credits, whatever. They'll get the maximum discount. So that's going to certainly help you guys use the V-Ray Cloud more if you guys want to use it. And as Kristen said, it'll go through April
30th. Yeah. Is it 30 days?
So, yeah. So it goes through April, I believe.
The last day of April.
Last day. I believe so. So, but double check the site. Mm-hmm. And then you will also be able to get, but they do expire after 3 months of purchase. So mm-hmm. we're sort of doing this to help people get through this hump, hopefully they'll be able to do some cloud rendering to get over whatever rendering needs they may have over time. But where can I find out more information about this? Is chaosgroup.com/cloud, V-Ray Cloud or something? Or
yeah, so. If you just go to chaosgroup.com, you'll be able to
find mm-hmm. that out. Okay, cool. And in terms of this podcast, where can I find more information, Kristen?
So if you go to facebook.com/cggaragepodcast or chaosgroup.com/cggarage.
Perfect. And if you guys would like to suggest ideas and have people on, let us know. labs@chaosgroup.com is our email. You can always email us there and just let us know what you want. With that being said, please enjoy this amazing podcast with Alex from our V-Ray GPU team.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
You haven't been on before, which is actually cool to have you on for the first time.
No, yeah, I haven't been on.
But
this is the first time, so I'm pretty excited.
Yeah, so it's cool because you know you've been doing GPU stuff for God, how long have you been on the GPU team now?
Well, in the beginning when I started at Chaos, there was a small time frame in which I wasn't sure in which exactly team I was, and back then I think the differentiation was not that good, so there were no specific teams, just people were helping each other and trying to do their best to make everything work. Then
right.
teams started to formalize here and there, and I think I've been on the GPU team as long as it's been there, like
right.
day one, I guess.
Yes, so that's at least what, 6 years?
5 years plus something. Yeah, almost 6 years. I've been at Chaos right. for almost 6 years now. Next month is my 6th year. So, yeah.
Okay.
Something like that.
Yeah, I just had my 6 year. So you're just after me.
Yeah. When did you start?
November 2013.
13.
I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I started beginning of June 2014.
Right. Okay. Okay. Cool. So, anyway, so you it wasn't formal that they had the GPU team, but it is now, mm-hmm. and you're now the head of the GPU team,
yep.
which is, a big responsibility. It's been pretty cool. Let's give people a little bit of a story of like, how did you get into programming? How did you end up at Chaos Group? How did that happen?
Well, that's a funny story. So mm-hmm. I guess I started programming because I was good at math, and I was, after I graduated high school, I was thinking, what should I do with my life and how should I approach stuff? I need to get a job. And since I was always good at math, I decided, well, programming is good for me. I never did programming in high school. I came from a language background, high school, no deeply involvement in mathematics or programming or anything like that, but decided to mm-hmm. go for it and started studying computer science at the University of Sofia. And I
okay.
I studied like 2 years, and at the end of second year, I didn't like it at all. I thought this was not the thing for me.
Right.
So I just quit and decided I'll go pursue something different. I was really into 3D. Ever since high school, I was playing around with Max and Maya and trying to model stuff out of nothing. And during the year when I was out of university, I was following tutorials, and because my dad actually is in the movie industry, he's an electrician.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what the term is. I think it's gaffer.
Right. Yes, but he's basically on the lighting team, basically.
Yeah, the lighting team. Yeah.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
So he met me with some guys doing CG here in Bulgaria. Uh-huh. So I started following them and trying to learn here and there. And while this was all happening, some friend of mine that was from my class at the university told me that there's this guy that's holding a brand new course at the university called ray tracing. And they're doing ray tracing there. And based on what I've told him, like what my interests are and what I like, he told me you should go there and check this out. So I went back to the university. You could attend this even though you weren't enrolled this year. And it was actually the best thing that I've seen so far about programming. And I suddenly decided this is what I want to be. This is what I want to do.
So suddenly it married your 3D interests, interests and your computer graphics interests suddenly found a way together.
Yeah. And that's what brought me back to the university. So I enrolled back next year and I graduated.
Wow. There you go.
Just when I got back in the university, in the year that I skipped, I didn't do any programming at all. And I was really, really bad at programming back then. Then I decided to apply at Chaos. I think it was 2011.
Okay.
And I went on an interview and I sucked a lot. I mean, now when I remember how the interview went, I'm even amazed that they actually invited me for a second interview a few years down the road when I applied the second time.
Right.
but I guess second time's the charm. So,
right. Yeah. Wow. Okay. All right. So that's how you ended up. Your interest in computer graphics what led you to ray tracing and programming. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah, and sheer luck. I mean, do you know Vesco? Unfortunately, he's no longer on the team.
Yeah.
He's the guy that held the ray tracing course at the university, and he's the guy that sparked the light in me.
Ah, okay. Well, that's fascinating. And that's good, because I think what we're going to try to do in this podcast is we're going to have a refresher course on what ray tracing really means, especially for people that talking about GPU ray tracing. I think that there needs to be a better definition that we need to define here and all the different problems and issues that are going on there. Obviously, you know, the big thing now that we've had a few talks about it, but specifically, GPU ray tracing is the big thing right now, right? A lot of people are talking about its capabilities, et cetera. And Chaos Group has been working on GPU ray tracing for 12 years, right? So 2008 is when we first started looking at GPU ray tracing. And back then, I don't think it was even, it wasn't even with CUDA. I think it was like trying to shove it into a shader somehow, right? Or like something weird that we were trying to do when we first, our very first implementation was not even through CUDA.
The very first implementation was actually in OpenCL. It was the first API for general purpose programming that came out. It was the first thing that allowed you to do general purpose computing on the GPU. Before that, it was really hacked through shaders. And as soon as OpenCL was out, we started doing ray tracing on the GPU. And I think it was about a year later that CUDA was released. So we naturally brought the two of them together, and we started building on a unified ray tracer that would work on both.
Right. Well, that's actually interesting. So we should do a little refresher on what an API is, because that actually is the way we started. We actually did have two different APIs going for a while. We had the OpenCL version and we had the CUDA version. The idea was that with OpenCL, we were just basically keeping our options open because of depending on which hardware people wanted to use, it wasn't necessarily tied to a specific piece of hardware because CUDA is tied to the NVIDIA hardware, right? Yep. And the OpenCL API is tied to any hardware, including CPUs, right? You can use CPUs as well, right?
Yeah.
So that was a big choice. And at some point, we abandoned the OpenCL, and it took a long time. We kept it going for a long time, but we abandoned the OpenCL because I guess we just weren't getting the performance or the features that we were getting from CUDA. Is that right?
Well, sadly, there's a OpenCL as an idea was perfect. So it was a portable API. You could write your programming in OpenCL and it would run everywhere on any GPU from any maker, even on CPUs. It was great. In theory. Mm-hmm. Sadly, in practice, if you want to be able to attend to everybody's needs, you need to make sacrifices. Like you need to cut this corner and that corner in order to suffice everybody's needs. And what eventually OpenCL became is a less powerful API than CUDA. CUDA was very tied to the NVIDIA platform. It was very performant, very optimized on NVIDIA hardware. We were trying our best to keep them both together, but at one point it just became too much of an effort on our side to maintain OpenCL. There were just too many features missing that we needed in order to give our clients the performance that we know we can extract from the GPU. This is eventually what led to our abandoning of the OpenCL platform.
Yeah, go ahead. I mean, it's also the fact that no one was, we knew how many people were using NVIDIA hardware versus not using alternatives, right? So there were very few people. I mean, almost every one of our users was using NVIDIA. So there was really no reason why we shouldn't just stick with CUDA the whole time, because that's, you know, 99.9% of the time, that's what people were using was NVIDIA hardware, right?
Yep, that's true.
Yeah. So supporting an API that basically would only satisfy 0.1% of our user base is not necessarily a good idea.
But as long as it was easy, we didn't mind it, but it was getting harder and harder over time. So
for a while, we were sticking with one API, and then suddenly now we have another API.
I guess that's the life of the GPU developers. There's always another API lurking just around the corner. Just when you think it's getting easier, no, it's not.
Yeah. So we still have a very robust CUDA base, right? Right now, CUDA is extremely good. It's very feature rich, and it does, you know, it works really well, and it's really fast. And we've added a second one, right? Which is the optics one, right?
Yes, this is true. Yeah.
So let's explain why we added optics.
Though there's a very, very simple reason actually why we added optics. As you know, the last generation of the NVIDIA GPUs, the Turing architecture, brought a very cool new feature to everybody. It's the RT Core. So the RT Core is a piece of hardware that's inside your GPU, and it's actually a separate processor designed specifically for ray tracing. So it can do ray to triangle intersection, or it can traverse trees for you. And because it's done in hardware, it's much, much faster than anything you can ever do with software.
Okay.
And the only way for us to access this new goodie was through the optics API. There's no direct access to the RT cores through CUDA. So if you want to benefit from that speed up that you get if you do your intersections in hardware, then you need to use the optics API. And this is why we started writing and rewriting V-Ray GPU over the optics API. And this is something that we've been doing for quite a quite a while now. Actually, the first time we heard that this is going to happen, Optix was at version 5.0, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So we started doing this with Optix 5.0, which is, right. I think, more than 2 years ago, maybe years ago. Through the course of time, Optix evolved a lot because this is something that nobody has ever done before. This is a brand new thing, and nobody was sure what's the proper way to do it. So when we first saw it in Optix 5.0, it wasn't perfect yet. So there were a lot of back and forths. We were very closely partnering with NVIDIA and sharing our feedback, what we need, the API would need, and how it needs to evolve and what needs to change in order to be really production ready for everybody out there to use in powerful production softwares like V-Ray GPU.
Right.
And we went through a lot of back and forths. There was Optix 5, 5.1, 5.2, then Optix 6 came in, 6.1, 6.5, and eventually we arrived at Optix 7,
right,
which is the final version that we are now running on, and we are completely feature complete, just as CUDA is. So every feature that we have in CUDA is there in Optix as well right now.
And that is we should note that is a huge effort, like to try to make everything work from one API to the other. That's like basically rewriting, you know, designing an entire new car to make it look exactly the same, but from scratch.
Yeah. So we basically changed the complete backbone of the renderer. So we had to revise everything from scratch. And the cool thing something that we're really proud of, though, is that we were able to design this and make the whole effort in such a way that we actually reused more than 99%. We're currently reusing more than 99% of the CUDA code base for Optix. So we changed our CUDA code in such a way so it shares the entire code base with Optix right now. So this is something that would
so you changed both
you
code
the exactly same. Yeah, yeah, we had
you
to change both
codes. Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
But we adjusted the CUDA code so it fits Optix in such a way that now they share the whole code base. So in order to support the two of the APIs together, it's a normal operation for us. It's easy.
Wow.
Every change you do in CUDA comes automatically in Optix. And the other great benefit of this is that no matter what you do, you know that the results you'll get from Optix are exactly the same as the results you'll get from CUDA.
Wow. There you go. That's a big deal. That's a really big deal.
Yeah. Yeah. It tells people that they can switch from CUDA to Optix at any point and it will be safe.
So we should note that when we go basically, you know, if you go into your current version of V-Ray in Maya or Max or whatever, our current released version of V-Ray does actually have the Optix option in there, right?
Most of them do. And if you're on a DCC or platform that still hasn't gotten the latest update, which is internally it's version 4.3, which was for Max it was update 2, I think.
Mm-hmm.
For Maya it was update 1, and I know that it's already shipping for Rhino, Houdini, and SketchUp.
Right.
But all the rest are coming later this year.
So the big thing to note is what you'll notice is that you'll have an option to render it in CUDA or render it in Optix. It is actually going to give you the same thing. The only difference between those two options is what hardware you have that supports it, right?
Yep.
So if you have a new hardware, like a new RTX card, then it's highly recommended. You just might as well just use the CUDA the Optix version, right? The Optix version is what you should be using for any GPU stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then the one thing that the Optix version currently does not support is adding the CPU as an additional processor, because I think the CUDA one does, but the Optix one does not support that yet, right?
Yeah, this is actually the only thing that Optix doesn't have, and there is a very good reason for this, and it's because when you render with CUDA everything is in our control. So we build everything, the acceleration structures, the geometry, everything is in our control. And when we have these acceleration structures, we don't care who's going to use them, like the CPU or the GPU.
It's, right.
But when it comes to optics, we no longer are in control of traversal because it's the RT core that does the traversal. So suddenly, suddenly we don't have those tricks. We don't have access to them. So we can't just tell the CPU to go and help the GPUs. If we want to do that and enable the CPU to do work parallel with the GPUs, we need to go through the step of building the trees on our own just for the CPU. And currently, this is a very time-consuming step. It's okay to do it when you do it for the GPUs as well, but now optics handles all that thing and it does it blazingly fast. And we are afraid that if you do that, it would actually maybe decrease even performance.
Right. Because you basically have to write it for optics, or the tree will have to be written for optics and then also written separately for the CPU.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. And also it will be probably two different algorithms. The optics algorithm for tree intersection is not open. So we need to match it somehow in the CPU in order to guarantee that you'll get the same result.
The same result. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So this is kind of an issue, but what you can do, because the CPU and the GPU code base are exactly the same and the CUDA and the optics code base are exactly the same, you can still, for example, if you have a RTX card on your machine and you want to offload your render for final frame rendering on a CPU render farm, you can still use CUDA CPU, like the hybrid mode for CPU only, and you know it will match the exactly your RTX result.
Right. So basically, you could do it in RTX and then switch it to CUDA and send it to the farm.
Yep.
Okay. All right.
You can locally with RTX and you can send it to the farm using CUDA.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that makes sense. Okay. So let's talk a little bit. I mean, obviously, we're all stuck at home doing our thing. And unfortunately, that means you had to miss the GTC conference, right? But you were supposed to give a talk there, and you did give a talk, but you had to give it remotely this time. I watched your talk, which was excellent. Very good talk.
Thank you
for doing that. And there was a lot of interesting questions in here, and you basically, we should put, you know, for those of you who, want to see it, I think it's free to register for the GTC conference, and then you can see Alex's talk on there. If not, it may just be online at some point, but we'll try to find a way to make sure you guys have a link to it and somehow check out Alex's talk, because it's very good and it's very concise, which is actually
There is a link in the forum section of V-Ray GPU. So if you go to Chaos Group forums and you go into the GPU section, you can find the link.
Perfect. But we also will put it in the show notes for this podcast as well, so people will have that as well. So just go to the Chaos Group, the CG
Even
Garage,
easier access.
Page, and we'll put the same link in there.
Great.
Okay, so a couple things. One of the big things. Let's get a little bit broader. Let's talk about the idea of what people are calling GPU ray tracing, because I think people are being very loose with this term, ray tracing on the GPU. You know what? Actually, no, let's not do that. Let's go back to V-Ray. Let's go back to V-Ray specifically. Let's talk about out of core, because this is a big thing that you've been dealing with specifically.
Yeah.
You and I have been having a conversation about this. I've been trying it out. I've been testing it. I've been writing blogs about it. Haven't come out yet, but we're still going into this. Out of core is a big, big deal. So let's explain what that is and the different levels of out of core, because I think that was something that was very interesting the way you broke down to me what out of core means at different stages, right? But let's first define what out of core is. Explain that for us.
So out of core in terms of GPU is the ability to offload some of your memory to the system memory, the CPU memory, in order to make room for more stuff on the GPU. So this is a very, very important feature for GPU rendering specifically. It is something that all the operating systems support by default. So on the CPU, you have out of core just naturally. It comes with the system. On the GPU, you don't have
such a thing. But it goes to the hard drive.
Yeah, that's another level of out, of course. So it goes from the system RAM to the hard drive.
Right.
And from there, it can even go somewhere on a network drive where you have infinite amount of space. But right. But every single hop, every single one of these means order of magnitude slower access to that memory. So if you're using your system RAM, for example, right. on the CPU, you have 12 gigabytes, 16 gigabytes of RAM. You're doing something that's taking a lot of RAM. Suddenly, you're out of RAM. There are two cases in this scenario. What's going to happen? One, you have disabled out of core. This is an option for you. You can disable it in the system settings. And when that happens and there's no RAM on the system, your application will 99% of the time just crash.
Right.
So there's nothing to do. You need more memory. There's not enough memory. The application crashes. If you have out of core enabled, and this is virtual memory on a regular system, it will start offloading some of your memory onto the hard drive to make mm-hmm. room for the new allocations that you need, the more memory that you need. The problem, though, is that at some point, your application may need back access to the memory that it has offloaded to the hard drive, for which the computer needs to remove another chunk from the system memory to a different location on the hard drive to bring the first location back in. And this is a very tedious and very slow process, because you need to go right. to the hard drive, you need to synchronize, you need to read chunks of memory, you need to bring them back to the system memory. It's a slow process. So,
and hard drive is much slower than memory.
Much slower. Yeah, it's order of magnitude much slower. Even if you're running this fastest hard drive out there, like the fastest
SSD
yeah. on a PCI slot, it will still be order of magnitude slower.
Right.
So you have probably seen this. When you're out of system RAM, your computer just becomes extremely sluggish, and it's hard to even move your mouse around. But it doesn't crash. It works. And this is the perfect the good thing of out of core, because, for example, imagine you're running a GPU render on overnight. Like you're running an animation, and in your animation there's this one frame that would go out of core. It would need more memory than you have on your GPU. Instead of crashing at that point, out of core would allow you to still render that frame. It would be slower, most probably slower, because you would need to evict some memory from the GPU VRAM to the system RAM so you can make room for the additional stuff that you need on the GPU. But eventually it will render out. And if it's, for example, mm-hmm. just this one frame, in the morning you can come safely to work and know that all your animation is done and ready. You pay some right. probably a few extra minutes for that render of that specific frame, but the whole thing is done.
Right.
And this is the cool part of out of core, that it would give you this safety that you know that the render will come through.
Right. But it's something we've been obviously looking at for a long time, right? Because it's challenging, because the idea of adding out of core can significantly slow down your render, even if you don't need the extra memory, right? Just it's a much more complicated way of looking at things, right?
Well,
so go ahead.
I'm saying that it's just memory accesses is the fundamental part probably of every program. So this is something that's the most natural thing. Like in this case, you need to replace it. Like it's a very hard problem. So if you start with out of core in mind from the beginning, it's probably easy. But V-Ray is, as you said, it started 2008, V-Ray GPU. There's mm-hmm. a lot of things in V-Ray GPU right now. It's a production ready render. It's very complicated. There's tons of features, and just going out of core at this stage is very, very hard. And you have to take a lot of things into consideration, and every change you do could be a potential disaster to performance. So we're very careful right. in how we make out of core, how we make our accesses, how we group requests for memory, for example. Everything needs to be very, very carefully selected and very carefully prioritized in order to give that performance that you need. So okay. even if you don't go out of core because you have changed the backbone, you have change basically everything, you can still suffer a performance penalty. And this is what we're trying to avoid here. We're trying to make it as perfect as possible. So when you don't need it, you don't pay the extra price for being able to go out of core when you need it.
Right. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about what is in memory, because the most expensive parts of the memory that that happen on a GPU are two things. Geometry and textures.
Yep.
Right. So there's several ways, and it was really cool the way you outlined it to me in that email that you sent me a few months back. It was like, there's several ways to think about it. One is on-demand memory, right? Where you load things only as you need them, only at the level that you need them for that specific purpose, which means just, let's say you don't have out of core. The thing you can do, let's say, is like, I just load everything, whether I need it or not, every resolution and every every piece of geometry or whatever, and then it'll render, because then I just have everything in memory. But you don't necessarily have that luxury, because GPU memory is expensive, right?
Yep.
So you do something what's called on-demand loading, right? And I think we've done it for, we've had that for a little bit on the texture side of things, right?
Yeah, we've actually had it for a few years now.
Right. So explain that, because it's really pretty simple if you think about it. But go ahead and explain how that works on the texture side.
But it's a great feature to have. And it's something that we will extend to out of core later on. So what on-demand textures is, as you said yourself, when you start rendering, you need access to all that data. For example, when an array hits a surface, it needs to evaluate the color. And for the color, it needs all the textures that this specific material needs. And before, because in the beginning of the rendering, you have no idea what you're going to need in the scene, you just load everything. And you loaded it all the different resolutions and mipmap settings and whatnot. And this can be really, really expensive on the VRAM. People are using constantly 8K textures and a ton of them. And all those textures, when expanded in memory, they take a lot of RAM. And as you said, VRAM is precious because you can't upgrade it. You can't just put in more VRAM.
Right.
And what on-demand textures does is it's a mechanism that allows V-Ray to start rendering without uploading any textures to the GPU. It just uploads placeholders, a tiny descriptions of what this texture is, so that when array during intersection hits a material, it can request from the CPU the texture that hit. And it not only it would do a request for the specific texture, but now that you know exactly how far away you are from the camera, you know how much the ray has dispersed, and you can take a lot of extra information because you're actually at runtime and you're exactly at this point at this hit. You have all the data you need, so you can make a request for a specific level of the texture. So you don't need the whole thing. You can just load a smaller piece of it, and you can filter it or pre-filter a tile on the CPU, so you can just get on the GPU just exactly what you need, not the whole thing.
Right.
And this happens for every ray. So essentially, you only load the textures that you actually need, not all of them, and you can downscale them to exactly the resolution you need, not the full size. So if you're looking at the texture from close up, it will be absolutely full size. But if you look at it from a really, really long distance, it will be just a small piece of filtered, blurred texture that would have absolutely no visual difference from the full whole thing. This is, but it will save you so much memory. So I've seen scenes go down from tens of gigabytes of textures down to just a single gigabyte, just one, because of this texture.
Well, that's the thing. People, basically what you're saying is people can be lazy and inefficient and make everything 8K textures and it doesn't matter anymore, right? Because we'll just load a resolution. We'll resize all your textures down to multiple levels, which are called mid-maps, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we'll load the resolution that we actually need for the render. So you don't say, oh, I need to make a 2K because I'm worried about RAM. Don't worry about it. Just make it all 8K if you want to, 16K, it doesn't matter. All the disk space you need. But you can still basically do that. Now, this is an important part of on demand, because on demand, what you basically outlined to me, which is very interesting, is that it'll load it in, but it won't unload it.
Yeah.
That's the thing. That's the new thing.
That's the new thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So let's explain that.
So with on-demand, you can take stuff in upon request, but there's no mechanism to offload things. So this is what we're actually working on right now. So when you implement the eviction, the possibility to throw things away, now this is the place where you go out of core. But okay. it's a hard thing to do though, because there's a lot of issues and problems that come with eviction. So whenever, for example, you hit something, you need, for example, a piece of geometry that you didn't have. Now you need to make room on the GPU for that piece of geometry, but you need to toss something out because there's no space. The decision what you should toss out is very important because it could dramatically affect performance. Also, you need to make sure that nobody else is currently using this. And on the GPU, this is hard because, for example, on the CPU, you have like 8 or 16, or even let's say you have a very powerful Xeon processor, you have like 100 threads, but on GPU, you have 3000 and more, and you may have more GPUs. So you need to make sure that nobody needs this.
So you have to check with 3000 threads and say, are you sure you're not using this?
Yeah, you have to make sure that nobody needs this. You have to do this without locking everybody because everybody needs to work and you have no option to tell anybody, stop working, I need to check something. So
Right. Everything
happens at runtime. So all those threads are just humming their rendering and you need to be able to throw stuff in, throw stuff out, bring stuff in. And this is the really hard thing. Because, for example, with on-demand, you know that when you hit, for example, a piece of geometry that wasn't there, you know that it wasn't there for everybody. And mm-hmm. when you bring it in, now it's in for everybody. And you know that it's going to stay there forever. But
right.
if you evict it at some point, now you have to take extra precautions because something that was there just a second ago can suddenly go missing. And you need to handle that case. And yeah, this is much, much harder than it sounds. This is why we're taking our time to make it perfect.
Yeah, well, this is a very big challenge. I know it's a very big challenge because obviously we've been, you know, this is why we've been working on it for so long. but it is an interesting problem because, you know, basically it's you want to go. It's when you go through the bus, when you go from one kind of memory to another kind of memory, mm-hmm. you want to go in that area as few times as possible for as short a time as possible. Right. And so predicting when you can get in and out is the big issue. Right.
Well, when you need to go out, you need to go out, but, so you're going to pay the price from going through the bus from one memory to another. That's a given. But you can make this worthwhile. So you can cram as many requests, for example, into that single go back and forth as possible in order to keep performance up. So you can't simply do this transaction from one bus to the other every single time you have a request. So you need to gather those. You need to issue requests at specific intervals, for example. So you make sure that the performance is optimal, so you can utilize this bus as much as you need to, otherwise you'll suffer. And another thing that out of core is very, very important, and I think a lot of people when they talk about out of core, they're just thinking about what happens when I go out of memory and what's the price that I'm gonna pay once, for example, I have a 10 gigabyte GPU, I have 12 gigabytes of scene that needs to mm-hmm. go in. But something a lot of people, I think, overlook, and this is a very, very important thing, is that are you sure that you need all those 12 gigabytes of your scene? A very important aspect of out of core is, for example, it would allow you to render scenes like 100 gigabyte scene into your 10 gigabyte GPU. If you're using a huge scene like a huge city, with skyscrapers and whatnot. And your camera is positioned in a single room in one of those skyscrapers. You don't need to go and simplify your scene and delete whatever you don't need in order to render it so you can fit in memory. With Out of Core, you can just render that scene straight out. And the renderer will automatically load only what it needs. So it will start even without geometry, even without textures, just boxes and placeholders for textures. And whenever Array hits something that it needs, it will load it into memory. But for example, in this case that I just gave, you're in a single room. So you're most probably going to need everything that's in the room and everything that you see directly outside through the windows and nothing else. So you won't load the whole,
right.
The whole scene, the whole city. You would only load what you can see. And this way, your scene might fit in your memory and you will never go out of core in the first place.
Right. But it is on demand then, right? Basically,
yeah,
it's the same
geometry loading.
Right. Okay. All right. Which is fine, which is great. So how does on demand geometry loading work? Right? Because you're basically doing the same thing as the MIT mapping, right? So have something that you have something that's going in that way. But we have different ways of doing things. So you mentioned, and people who have used V-Ray for a long time have seen the term static memory versus dynamic memory, which is, I'm sure, where we're going to go here. Static geometry or dynamic geometry.
Yeah.
So let's define what that is and what is the advantage of one over the other. So because I think that's how this all starts, right?
Yeah. So from the beginning of V-Ray, there's been two types of geometry. So there's static geometry and there's dynamic geometry, or at least that's what we call them.
Right.
So they're very different while they serve the same purpose. So it's all geometry. It's just an acceleration structure that V-Ray intersects in order to find in the fastest way possible the hit along the distance of the ray so you can shade it. There are two ways, basically. Well, there are many ways, but there are two ways that we use to intersect with geometry. One is when you put all your triangles into one and the same acceleration structure. So all your meshes, you group them together and you build one huge acceleration structure over all the triangles. This is what we call static geometry. Yeah, one big tree over all your triangles across all your meshes. This is what we call static geometry. So all your static geometries in V-Ray will go into one single tree. The opposite to this is to have a separate tree for every mesh that you have, and then you build a secondary tree on top of the first one, which just bounds those meshes. It's called a BVH tree, a bounding volume hierarchy. The difference between the two is that static tree, when you build one single acceleration structure over all your triangles, is generally faster than the other one. It's not a big difference, but it's noticeable, especially on bigger scenes. So why then we have dynamic geometry? Well, usually people like to fiddle with their scenes, like in interactive rendering. Start your render, you build your acceleration structure, everything's working perfectly, and now you want to move a certain piece of geometry. But in the static tree, because everything is in one place, if you move one piece of geometry, you have to rebuild the whole tree once over again. Even if you just moved it,
right.
It's a change in the tree and you have to rebuild the whole thing. And because there's probably millions and millions of triangles in that, it's expensive. You need to wait for a few seconds for this whole thing to rebuild.
Right.
On the other side, you have dynamic geometry, where every single geometry is in a tree of its own. So if you move a tree over, a piece of geometry over, you don't need to rebuild everything. Most probably, you have to rebuild only the tree that this geometry represents, which is a smaller thing, like a few hundred thousand or millions of polygons. And you have to rebuild the BVH itself, the secondary tree on top of the first one. But it's also very, very small because there's as many nodes in it as there are nodes in your scene.
Right.
So this is very, very fast to update. And This is why we have both of them, because one of them is good for interactive rendering, the other one is good for final rendering. And
right.
also the problem of the static tree is that it doesn't allow instancing. So if you have a huge
right.
piece of geometry and you want to instance it a few times, in the static tree you have to actually copy it a few times. But
right.
if you don't want to pay that price, you need to be able to just reuse the geometry. And in this case, you have to make it dynamic. You have no other choice.
Right.
So in out of core, from where we started, you need to be able to very fastly and rapidly remove things from your scene and bring them back in. And for that reason, static geometry is not a good idea to have, because if you're every time you need to remove a few triangles from your scene, you have to rebuild the whole tree again and again and again. This will kill performance right there. So you have to use dynamic geometry when you go out of core.
Right.
And this is actually something that we're doing. So if you enable out of core, we will no longer put any of the meshes in static geometry. Everything
right.
will go. Everything will be dynamic. And this is another thing that we're doing. We're trying to optimize our dynamic trees as much as possible so there's no performance hit. Because, as I said, in static geometry, it's a little bit faster.
Right. Right. But you're taking the hit for convenience. Like, you know, that's
yes.
that's okay,
yes.
right? It's a little bit faster, but you're able to, it's you know, you can do evictable memory and all that other stuff, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And also,
so,
there's a few tricks up our sleeve, some things that we're doing currently in V-Ray that we will do with out of core as well.
Okay. Okay. But let's bring back that idea. So now that we've looked at the geometry way of doing things, it's basically like mm-hmm. a bunch of mipmaps, right? So you have a master tree, which is your BVH tree, right?
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
you just load what you need on demand into your scene, and then et cetera, you're good to go. Very similar to the mipmap leveling of mipmap
yep.
level of textures.
Yep.
However, we are also looking at evicting things, because some people are saying that they do quote unquote out of core, but really what they're doing is just doing on demand. They're not actually doing evictable memory, right? That's the,
yep.
that's like the what we are defining as out of core is when we actually have evictable geometry in that situation,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep. So the difference between the two is, for example, with the skyscraper scene and the city scene that I said. So if you have on-demand geometry loading, which is just a part of what out of core is. So out of
mm-hmm.
core has on-demand geometry loading, but it has much more. So if you have on-demand geometry and you're, for example, doing an interactive session in this specific scene with the skyscraper and stuff, you can start rendering and everything that's in the scene and everything that's outside through the window will get loaded and it will fit in your GPU, for example. But if you try to move your camera around and you want to go outside of this room during the session, you'll suddenly start hitting more stuff and you would need to put more stuff in the memory, more trees, more meshes, everything. And suddenly you're out of memory.
Right.
And if you just have on-demand loading at this point, you'll crash because there's no way you can remove stuff from the GPU in order to make room for the new stuff. And with out-of-core, you can. And another thing, by the way, that out-of-core is very good at is this specific scene where you're in one room, for example, in your set, and you move on to another room. Now,
right.
you can't fit both rooms in the memory, but you're never in both rooms at the same time. So when you go in the other room for a few cycles, you'll be out of core because you need to remove all the stuff from the first room and load everything in the second room. But once you're
right.
in the second room and you evict everything from the first room, you're no longer out of core again. Everything
right.
fits in memory and you can be fast.
Right.
And
right, right.
this is the holy grail. This is what we're after. This is what we want.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting thing. But you know, what's also amazing is that, you know, the GPUs have gotten they've gotten faster, obviously, as we know. And they've gotten new special cores like the new RT cores, et cetera. But they've also gotten a huge amount of memory recently. You know, like the fact that your standard gaming card can have, you know, 11 gigs or 12 gigs of memory is pretty darn good.
this is pretty darn good. But then you can look at the professional tier cards when you have
right.
stuff like the RTX 8000, which has 48 gigabytes of memory, and you can
yep.
actually NVLink those together.
And get 96
so you can,
gigs.
Yeah. So things are getting really, really out of hand. And
right.
can you imagine
I
going out
have...
of core with 96 gigs?
Well, I'll tell you what, I've tried and I had a massive scene mm-hmm. and I was like, okay, I'm really going to test this NVLink to see how far, and it was this massive, massive scene. And I was sure because it on the CPU, it took like over 140 gigs or something like that to
mm-hmm.
render, right? It was a ridiculous amount. And so I was like, well, this is great because now I have 96 gigs of memory on the GPU. So I'm going to be able to do this, right? I'm going to be able to see how it's going to go out of core. The problem was that because I implemented the on-demand textures, you know, the mapping textures, turns out I only needed 39 gigs of memory on the GPU. So I couldn't even go out of core on one of them. So
yeah.
Yeah, so it's a it is so our the way we deal with memory, I mean obviously memory is so important on the GPU. The way we've dealt with it for a long time is to be really really smart about how we put it into memory. So
yep.
we're already smart in what some ways, and the on demand is going to be a big is going to do a big thing. But even so, even if you start to run out of memory, we still have the ability, what we're going to be doing, obviously, with evictable stuff, we still have the ability to continue to render no matter what, right? It
yep.
won't crash.
Yeah. This is the goal. We want to make the renderer so resilient that no matter what you toss at it, it will produce a result. It won't crash. It would render it out. Maybe
right.
it would take longer if you really, really... stressful at it, like if you have a few gigabytes and you want to render hundreds, yes,
right.
it will be slow. But the goal here is to make it resilient and handle anything.
Right. Okay, so I have one more thing. Alex, are you part of the Lavina team at all? Are you working on Lavina?
No, not at all. I'm
okay.
familiar with the people working on Lavina, but I'm not on the team. It's
all right.
A completely
so I will,
different
I...
team.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just going to ask you to chime in as an advice and knowing that you're not actually on the team.
Okay.
But Lavina for us is our real-time ray tracer.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I want to talk about here is there's something very specific that real-time ray tracing that we are doing that other people that are claiming to have real-time ray traces are not doing. And that is that we are doing 100% ray tracing, no rasterized rendering at all.
Yep.
Right.
That's true.
So one, while this sounds, you know, like, okay, so what's the difference? As long as it looks good, it's good. But there's one thing specifically that we can do that I want to figure out if you can find a good way to explain it. We can load a huge amount of geometry compared to rasterized rendering and render that in real time. And it almost doesn't even matter. You can just keep throwing more and more and more geometry and it doesn't slow it down.
Mm-hmm.
How is that possible? And why is that only possible with fully ray traced scenes compared to rasterized scenes?
So that's actually the definition of ray tracing. So,
oh,
ray tracing,
okay, there we go. Go back
tracing,
to your schoolwork, right?
Yeah. Ray tracing and rasterization are two very different techniques for drawing on the screen. So,
okay.
Rasterization was invented with the goal to render a lot of pixels on the screen. So, it's pixel oriented, let's say. So,
okay.
it's very fast at drawing pixels. But and there's a fixed pipeline, there's hardware along the way. People have done a lot to optimize rasterization over the years. And there's a lot of, as I said, hardware involved in it. That's why it's blazingly fast. But essentially, in rasterization, when you want to draw a pixel, you have to linearly go through all the triangles in order to find which triangle in your scene maps to that pixel, so you need to render it. So for every pixel, you need to go linearly through every triangle out there. And And when there are many triangles in the scene, rasterization starts to suffer. And this is why in games, for example, you're limited by poly count, and everything that's using rasterization is limited by poly count, because your operations are linear. For every operation, you need to go through every single triangle to check. While in ray tracing, you have acceleration structures, you have trees. So when you have a ray and you want to find which triangle it hits, you just can divide your triangles into two big boxes, like put them into two boxes, and check whether your ray intersects any of the boxes. So if it intersects the first one but doesn't intersect the second one, you can directly eliminate half of your scene. And this process repeats.
Right.
The second time, you remove the half of what's left of your scene, and then you remove the half of what's left of your scene. And if you have 1,000 triangles, in just 10 steps, you can find the one that you're after. And in rasterizations, you need to do 1,000 steps. Now,
right.
Rasterization is fast because it does that in hardware. And up to this point, ray tracing had to do it in software. But now, with Lavina and with RTX, you can do that in hardware as well. So you have all those triangles, but you can intersect them blazingly fast.
And interesting.
Optics, something that Optics also does, it can compress the geometry in it can reduce the memory footprint on the geometry and expand it in hardware later. So it can actually take less memory than rasterization and be faster than rasterization. This is why I can put so many triangles there and have real-time performance.
That's amazing. Okay, now we should also note that these RT cores are their first, mm-hmm. these are the beginning of them. These are the first gen, almost the first generation of this, right? So at the beginning of ray tracing, and that it's just going to get faster and faster from now on, right?
Yep. It will definitely be faster. And the interesting thing here is that ray tracing is comprised of two parts. There's tracing and there's shading. So if you just remove the tracing, you're still left with the shading. So if your scene, for example, takes 1 hour to render, 50% of the time is tracing, 50% of the time is shading. If you make intersections so fast that it's free, you're still left with a 30-minute render because you still have to pay the price for the shading. But I'm very optimistic that now that ray tracing is so fast and intersecting ray is so fast, there's a lot of good things for us in the future for shading. So the next thing to do is make shading fast.
Okay, that's good. That's good to know. Now let's talk about one more thing. On these things, especially in video games, you're seeing a lot of real-time ray mm-hmm. tracing, right? And they're really basically all they're adding is just reflections on top of rasterization.
Yep.
But what they're really doing is you have to render it twice now. You have to render it a rasterized version and then put ray tracing on top, right?
This is true, but for game engines, it's not a new thing because they still had to render twice the reflections. And even though they had to render twice, so they do one pass without reflections and then they do a second pass where they just position the camera at the location of the mirror, for example, so they can see what's on the other side, so they can blend them both together. This is how reflections were done before in games. Now they can, though, for every bounce, you had to reposition your camera and render a new scene, and then you have to reposition the camera and render a new scene. So this is very, very expensive. You can't do it all the time, and you for every mirror, actually you have to do it for every mirror and every reflective surface. So you have to be very careful what's reflective in your games and what's not. And now you can do it just like that because it's ray tracing. This is what ray tracing is all about.
Right. But if you did fully ray trace, then you just don't even have to worry about anything. Then everything is just one geometry, one thing, et cetera, right?
Yeah. With games, they also, in order to maintain steady FPS with all that going on, so for example, you're not doing full ray tracing. You're doing ray tracing, but you're doing also rasterizations for your game. And you're engaging the hardware in two different aspects here. So it's already stressed out enough with rasterizations, so you don't have a lot of room for ray tracing out there. So they're very, very careful on how much they ray trace, what they do with ray tracing. They actually, instead of doing full ray tracing, they do just a few samples in order to sample, for example, the reflection and have a general idea how it should look like, and then they apply denoising and all that stuff to recreate the rest of the image that they don't have in order to provide a visual feedback in real time. While with ray tracing, you just fully go all in with ray tracing on the GPU, and you can do everything.
Right. Yes. Yeah. And that's a big difference. I think that people should, you know, realize what those differences are, because that's, you know, when we're looking at real-time ray tracing for us is fully ray trace. We are a ray tracer. We don't write a rasterized engine, right? So we are going fully ray traced in Lavina, and that's a big difference. Mm-hmm. And that's why we can do huge amounts of geometry, much more than any kind of rasterized engine can do, as just put in global illumination, put in real reflections, real glossy reflections, and everything else. Yep. And it looks really good. So this is cool. Well, listen, Alex, this has been really interesting, and I think I'm very excited about to know where Out of Core is going and the fact that it's coming and you're able to talk about it at GTC. We'll make sure to put the link in the show notes for that. Yep. And I'm always happy to check in with the GPU team and see where that's going, because it's always a big story for us. But I really appreciate it. But we will definitely have you back on to continue talking about this, because this is always something that I'm fascinated with. When we talk about pure ray tracing, it's like, huh, mm-hmm. You know, you really start to think about what the implementations are and how cool it is really cool technology. And it was fun to hear your story about, like, you weren't really interested in programming until you finally figured out ray tracing. This is cool.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
It's the coolest thing out there.
Okay, awesome. Well, listen, just so you know, because we're using this system, when I hit stop, it's going to upload our uncompressed audio to the system, so you need to stay on. But anyway, I appreciate you coming on, Alex. Thanks so much.
And don't mention it. It was a pleasure.